We have a guest today, Svi Rostov. Please correct my pronunciation, Svi, if that needs it, along with Horace and I. And I want to open by just I was struck at the recent Apple.
Well, before we begin, hold on a second. Yes, let's, okay. I want to make sure we people know who Svi is.
Yes.
So Svi Rostov is a CFA. I believe you have a PhD in it. Is that right?
Well, I have a PhD in finance and a CFA charter, yeah.
Right.
So CFA is the Chartered Financial Analysts Institute. We are a nothing to do with cars. We are a membership organization for the investment management industry. So we sort of advocate for market fairness, market integrity, investor protections. Part of that is we have this exam that is very well known in some circles. Part of that is sort of regulator outreach and thought leadership, but none of it has anything to do with cars.
Well, everything has to do with cars. but more to the point. So is that an is the CFA just indulge me for a minute? Is the CFA exam that you mentioned is that a global thing or is that something that is regional, like Europe or UK?
No, so the exam is in three parts, taken over 3 years if you pass each time. It's done on a single day globally. Tens of thousands of students all are marshaled into a large warehouse in different locations, and there's 2 3-hour exams with a small lunch break, and then a few months later you find out if you get to suffer through the next one.
I see. And it's sort of like a financial – you become a certified financial analyst.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So if you jump through some additional hoops, there you are allowed to call yourself a CFA charter holder. And so it's a sort of a signal of, you know, integrity, knowledge, work experience in the investment management industry. It's been around for a while.
The reason I ask is because I've always been curious, what are the criteria for getting someone invited to a conference call with the CFO or whoever is conducting the earnings conference call? The U.S. tradition of having a conference call after earnings. The thing was, there over the years, people asked me, "Well, why don't you go and ask a question at this conference call?" I said, "Well, because nobody's invited me to be on it, and I don't know what it takes to get invited." And I asked around, and I think the only criteria wasn't that you had to have a CFA. The criteria was that you had to work for a bona fide
a name firm
institution. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know what some of these institutions I know is a one person institution. So I'm not sure what the rules are there. Any clues on that?
Well, we don't like to get involved in commercial entities. We stick to the safe stuff. So I don't think anyone is inviting us to any conference calls. You must be on.
Do you know the criteria? Are there criteria?
No. I suspect it might be a little bit the case of getting published. You know, there's the famous Journal of Friends of the Editor.
I see.
Oh, sure. See. Relationships, you know, if Goldman's doing a debt offering for Apple, they may well be invited, right?
Yeah, I guess there's no rules. Anyway, so that's what that CFA means.
Maybe Twitter followers. Maybe that's
Twitter followers.
Yeah, well, maybe that's in the future. Because it took a while for Apple to actually invite bloggers to things. I wouldn't say just... but to be using bloggers as its primary channel for communicating its agenda, because it used to be that they would go through Time magazine or something like that, and now they'll call up John Gruber and say, I'll be on your show as a way to that's only
to reach the market
in the last year. So who knows? They might change the whole conference call thing. Mm-hmm. Now you're not here to talk about that. I think what we want to do. You are so the reason we invited you is that you are active on Twitter, often coming in with insight about the car industry. And I'm just curious, given your background, given the fact that you don't work in the industry, why do you get engaged on that topic?
Good question. Well, I think it was just starting as a kid. You know, you would. I remember standing at the fence. I grew up. I spent part of my childhood in Russia, so I would stand at the fence at our country house and try and recognize all the weird Soviet cars driving past, and it sort of snowballed from there. Oddly, I've never had any interest in owning or driving cars. I've only really been interested in sort of the business side, the industrial side, the production side. So, I don't know, I just find it fascinating for some reason.
Mm. One day we should have you and my son.
Yes.
Because my son, and this is the first time this will be revealed, and I'm almost embarrassed to say this. My son is a fan of Russian cars.
Yes,
And it's a perverse thing to me because
they're terrible.
They're not known as good cars. Let's put it mildly, and I don't know what it is that somehow. But he has many fans. He's a fan of many things, but he became obsessed with collecting Russian toy cars or toys made of Russian cars. I don't think they're made in Russia. They're still made in China like everywhere else. But it was funny because our house got filled in then with all of these Russian cars. And I ended up learning something about Russian cars as a result. I know what a Pobeda is. I know the various forms of Ladas that were made. And of course, the four-wheel drive version of Lada, which I think is not called Lada. Neva.
Yeah, I think Chevrolet owns the brand to that now, so it's the Chevy Neva, which is
interesting.
One of the premier marks of General Motors.
It's fascinating because also there was a big Cards of the People episode. I'm sure you've seen it with James May, which goes into the Lada plant, and they take a nice aerial photograph or aerial film of the plant, and it looks the size of a city. It is the biggest thing I've ever seen, and
it's the biggest one in the world by square footage.
It's amazing. I never knew that. I never knew that Lada had the biggest plant in the world in terms of manufacturing cars. And also, of course, we know that the Lada, the sort of iconic Lada, is actually a Fiat 124. But I didn't know that they just centralized manufacturing in one plant for the whole country and presumably for much of the world, to which they exported these cars, which included crazy places like England.
Well, the worrying thing about the Fiat 124 is that in the 60s they actually had a relatively thorough trial of various Western models. Essentially, they put out to tender the next Soviet family car, and they would, you know, take these Renaults and Fiats and, you know, I don't know what was around back then, Talbots or Peugeots or something, and drive them around, you know, the Caucasus Mountains until they fell apart. And somehow they figured out that the Fiat was the best option, which I'm sure is...
Well, I'm sure...
Some people would find ironic.
I'm sure there was some
politics, absolutely. Yes.
To say the least, the film I saw suggested it had something to do with the labor unions in Italy being
right.
Very militant and very communist.
Yes.
But anyway, let's refocus a bit on Jim, you wanted to start us off with the topic. Why don't you go ahead?
I did, yes, and I'm glad you mentioned Apple because one of the things I noticed, I saw a few screens from their recent announcement, and it somewhat surprised me that they were emphasizing the cost per month of their iPhone line strongly. You know, it used to be, what, $699, $599, so much to buy it or per month. But we seem to have maybe it's the cell phone or the financialization of everything, which is why I think this is an interesting show today. But I remembered Henry Ford, and it took Henry 9 years – to quote Svi, to be relieved of his hubris and respond to General Motors Acceptance Corporation. You know, that Ford had relied on old-fashioned layaway plans as the method to buy a car. You'd drop your $5 or $10 off at the dealer every week, and then eventually when you had enough, your car would be handed to you. General Motors in 1919, of course, formed GMAC, changed the game in many ways, And so we've talked about this on previous shows. You know, are there business model innovations? Are there things that will change the game in such a investment or capital heavy industry? And I think that's really my first question for Svi. Is there something out there in the money game?
Let me also introduce a bit of color to this. I'm using this term loosely because I'm speaking in front of a CFA. But the point is that actually even that innovation that, I mean, that process of layaway that Ford introduced or was using as kind of the default financing model was itself a huge innovation of the late 19th century. The layaway was what was used by the Singer company, which was manufacturing sewing machines,
exactly.
And in order to allow people, mainly women, to own these machines, they instituted this layaway plan, which absolutely took the business to a new level. It just completely exploded the adoption curve. And you have to give credit to these simple ideas that we take for granted now, but they were big ideas at one point. They were totally innovative ideas and involved a lot of risk-taking to get to that point, even of layaways and then eventually financing cars. And one thing I would also take careful thought about is that the notion of financialization, we have to be careful. This isn't just financing. Financing, in my mind, is not financialization. Financialization is looking at everything as if it were finance. Finance is useful and is very powerful, but you shouldn't make it dominant in your thinking as a business manager. It's not the thing you optimize. Anyway, that's my thought. So please
Svi,
help us think
yes,
it through.
Dive in.
So the question is, are there any innovations? Well, I guess extending car leases for ever longer and longer and longer is the latest one that seems to be happening. Also, there's a lot of funny business going on with dealers self-registering cars and then selling them as CPOs.
Yes, I read something in Europe about that recently. Exactly.
Yeah, anything up to 30%, some people reckon, of
Can you tell us what does CPO mean?
So they sell BMW will have a CPO program, certified pre-owned. So it's a near new model, gone through top to bottom by BMW, ostensibly good as new, but slightly used. So a factory approved used car, essentially. And what happens is they actually, you see this a lot. Someone I know recently took advantage of this. Is that towards the end of a month, the dealer will essentially self-register demo cars or courtesy cars in order to get some kind of factory bonus for meeting sales numbers, and then the next month sell them as certified
CPO.
Pre-owned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that seems to be there. Seems to be evidence that this is really this, along with extending lease terms into sort of infinity. Are really, really maybe sowing the seeds of a future problem. I know a lot of people in writing about the industry kind of pointing it out, trying to get people to pay attention.
That is a worry, isn't it? I mean, we think about it. Yes, finance is powerful. It enables people to own what they couldn't otherwise. But taken to extremes, it can be leading to great abuse. And I think this is a great example where... So I'll give another example from memory, which is that the Ford F-150, as we know, is the most popular vehicle in the United States, maybe one of the fastest selling cars in the world in terms of units sold per month or day or what have you. But the interesting thing is that its price keeps climbing, so it's a hugely powerful product.
Yeah. In 60,000, yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's well above $50,000 for something which is supposedly a workaday vehicle that the average American is interested in. And when I saw these figures climbing and climbing, I said, how can people afford it? And the answer, it turns out, apparently, is that people will finance it in exceedingly long periods, like way beyond the usual five. I don't know. I think it was 4 years not too long ago, where 4 year loan for a car loan, right? And now it's up to 8, 10, maybe longer.
Yeah.
And that is a worry because the asset depreciates very quickly, and it's not clear what happens if people say, you know, I'm under this. I mean, I'm paying a monthly whatever it is, $400 or $500 for a car that is not worth that much money. Is that what the problem would be with this?
Yeah. Well, so in I guess in the States, you would just throw the keys back at the dealer and walk away. But yeah, the problem is that the earnings, these sorts of earnings are not as high quality as someone putting down cash, right? So there's some provision for non-performing leases. And so the more of your sales that are as a proportion that are leased, yeah, you can get high numbers. Yeah, you can probably get high unit prices because, you know, you can option up a car. It doesn't add that much to the monthly payment, even if it does add a ton to the full price. But you know, if you push it too far, you might sort of end up with a bit of a bubble, like we've seen before in the housing market. But I think your question was, do I see anything new coming?
Right, right. And let me give you one example to maybe put a little bit of gas on the fire. In the 60s, the term was coined by Bristol Siddeley, apparently, called power by the hour. So I'm thinking about the information layer, and the idea is that you pay as you're using a business jet aircraft, or I think GE has adopted it in Rolls-Royce for aircraft engines as well. You pay, you know, you can buy it, but you can also pay, and then they bundle in maintenance and all that. So I'm thinking, might we see a further jump in this financing scheme or paying more based on usage? We know your drive. We know the type of driving you do, you know, all those things. So will there be newer business models, maybe something between Uber and leasing a car that is more demand-based, let's say? And that was really the gist of my question.
Well, I think everyone is convinced that, yes, there will be, and no one knows what it will be. So you probably noticed this, the latest buzzword is that every company is going to become a mobility company, right?
Of course.
No one has any idea what a mobility company actually does. Mm-hmm. One suspects what they want to do is to make people use, you know, the BMW Uber or the Mercedes Uber. And so instead of just calling, you know, an Uber where some guy with a Prius shows up, you will have a pay-as-you-go access to the fleet at your local Audi dealer. Whether or not that's going to sustain the business as it is now, I'm not sure, because, you know, clearly you don't need as many cars if they're getting used more. And a lot of these brands are not making that many margins even on existing sales. So if the fundamental sort of demand for units is lower because they're all being shared in some form,
exactly,
how are they going to sustain their high capital costs? So I think everyone is perfectly convinced that everything has to change, but no one knows when, how, or what it will look like.
Mm-hmm. So the reason you need change is why, though? I mean, you have the head of Fiat saying this is unsustainable. You have strange behavior. And we've talked about this. When you study the industry from the outside, there are peculiarities about it that just abound. There are things like the dealer network, the fact that every company seems to own a piece of every other company, the fact that they seem to take forever to make change happen, just even basic product development. Although it's shrinking in duration, it's still fairly long. And so there's a lot of mysteries about the auto industry that are very, very, very unique. And so what is his name, the CEO of Fiat, which is now Fiat Chrysler? What did he say about this?
Sergio Marchionne or Marchionne?
Marchionne, right, yes, Marchionne. Marchionne. So Sergio, right. So he's the one who's essentially gone out and made a very public accusation that the industry is doing it all wrong. And what's your take on his point?
Yeah, so for the listeners, he released a slide deck, I think last year, which went through, the thrust of it was essentially that the auto industry destroys capital. It requires such vast amounts of fixed capital investment in order to essentially duplicate endlessly research and development. So what does that mean? If you look around, every single car company has, you know, a 2-liter four-cylinder turbo engine. They're all exactly the same. They're all completely unique. The Germans are famously, you know, within 0.5% of each other on all technical aspects. But each one is billions in duplicated R&D costs, which the customer doesn't care about. It's not clear that it provides any marketing or sales advantage, really. But it does erode any ability to make a return. And his argument was that at some point, the market will realize that this is a terrible industry to invest in and will force sort of cataclysmic change, kind of, you know, really significant consolidation, which, as you've alluded to in previous podcasts, might not be possible because of all the national interests in each automaker.
Here's the thing that I want to restate what you said, just to, in a slightly different language, which is that and I'm glad you brought this up because it's what I felt rather than saw, which is that the industry seems to be highly integrated in that each company thinks that it needs to make its own engines. And the way I would put this is that it resists modularization. It resists being the product and that is the whole value chain of the product being broken down to its most essential independent bits. To some degree, and this is where I struggle, because to some degree they have outsourced huge swaths of what they do. They've outsourced a vast supply chain. However, in some cases there is this resistance. Why do the Germans have 4 different 2.0 engines? Why does each manufacturer actually have more than one, or a dozen, or whatever it is that the minimum number should be? The reason this comes up is because if you go to an electric drivetrain, it actually might it might cause this modularization to happen and break up the value of integration, essentially. That there, I think that the car companies would argue, well, there's value in us mating the proper engine to the proper chassis, to the proper suspension, to the proper everything, and thus creating a whole product which feels better than what you might get from the parts bin. But and again, indeed, this is Apple's argument. Our computers are better because we although we use many off-the-shelf parts, we integrate them with software and services to such a degree that it's a smooth and great experience. And to argue that the car industry is doing it wrong because they're integrated, how can I say that when I say what Apple is doing is right? And the answer is that it all depends on when you ask the question. If the product is new, you want it integrated and you want it to have smoothness of experience and polish and everything else. But if it's 100 years old, it doesn't make sense to operate that way. So this is the question. Why are you driving towards with integration as your operating model? What does it lead to? In what improvements does it lead, rather than, you know what I mean? This is a critical dilemma, I think, for the industry. And I think this is what Sergio was pointing out, if only through a different language.
Yeah, well, and the odd thing is that they do modularize sort of within companies, right? So like Audi will be, you know, famously they build the sausage in 3 different lengths, right? But basically
they have a platform logic internally. Yeah. And so did Nokia, by the way. Nokia had a huge platform logic internally, but not within the value network of the whole industry.
Well, the other odd thing is that they do it to some extent. So ZF is a very big provider of gearboxes, and these days pretty much all the premium cars have the exact same ZF gearbox, which they buy off the shelf, sort of put a you know, CPU flash on it to suit the car, and off they go. But I think there's some kind of a mental block regarding, no pun intended, the engine, where perhaps they think that once they give that up, they're nothing. They're just a badge on the hood, and there's no integrity to the brand anymore. That's the only thing I can think of.
I think it's actually sales as well. Just to jump in, I think it's actually sales as well. You know, I talked with a friend in this industry a while ago, and he mentioned demand from certain geographies or certain large dealers that drive specific models that should have been killed some time ago. And it was all about maintaining the volume, maintaining the relationships with those dealers, maintaining the option sales, the financing. It's sort of a perverse increasing returns, right? You have it, therefore you need to keep doing it. And changing that is very difficult.
They're bound by a lot of things that they're manufacturing, the way that is set up, the dealer network, and the way sales are working, the regional aspects, the certainly the regulatory aspects, and certainly the fuel and infrastructure aspects. All of these things you can point to and say, aha, here's a linkage or a dependency, and therefore that's the cause. But it isn't, I think, sufficient because you have many, many of them, firstly. But secondly, it's sort of breaking, cutting through the Gordian knot. It's sort of looking at it and asking, but fundamentally, what is this entity for? And it is for delivering transportation, for improving experience or whatever. And this is why I think this is where people are just blind men in the room trying to fill out the elephant and trying to say what it is. And I think this is where it's very valuable to have your input on this and think about it also from the point of view of finance, from the point of view of industry dynamics in Europe in particular. And by the way, you are based in the UK, is that correct?
Yes, in rainy London, where the weather is terrible as usual.
We couldn't tell from your accent, by the way. So,
apologies.
You do bring a European, presumably a strong European point of view here. Although you seem to be well versed also in other regions. So this is what I'm trying to get at is the modularization versus the job to be done. And the job to be done, if that changes, you can go back to integrating. But if it doesn't change, you have to modularize. And it hasn't been changing very much. The problem of defining the measure of performance of the industry, you know, that changes over time gradually. And of course, you know, initially it was just get me in one piece from A to B. Then it became more about, you know, communicating my status to the world. Then it became more about ergonomics or sensations of driving. Then it became more about conveniences and making the drive tolerable with cup holders. And now we're sort of running out of these things. We can't anymore throw things at the user and say, here, buy this because it is better on this dimension. In fact, we lamented about this before, is that all the brands are undifferentiated. The BMW doesn't mean, or the Mercedes doesn't mean what it used to mean. And so we're struggling. And so tell me again why I should trust you is the question.
Right. Well, I don't know really. In terms of comparing it to the, let's say, an industry where this seems to have gone quicker and more sort of logically, you know, the smartphone industry where Apple showed up with a better thing and it took over and it took over the market quite quickly. The only thing I can come up with why the car industry has basically gone nowhere in 100 years is maybe the job to be done hasn't changed. Maybe the roads haven't changed. Congestion hasn't changed. It's still four tires and a steering wheel. And the fact that all of this stuff is so capital intensive, the lead times are so long, maybe that just somehow stifles the ability to make these kinds of strategic decisions. And so all they're ever doing is reacting to legislation that they're fighting against constantly. You know, the safety legislation, the emissions legislation, the autonomous legislation is going to be something that's they're going to have to deal with. So maybe somehow is just not, the dynamics just don't work in a nice way.
It's exactly right. It looks like a complexity problem rather than simply the, oh, hi, I see a eureka moment here. One other thing I want to go back to is you mentioned you mentioned capital intensity, and you said that Sergio was saying how the industry destroys capital. This is actually at the heart of a lot of the debates on what we call the capitalist dilemma, is that a lot of companies have become obsessed with capital return, or return on capital, I should say, this ROC measure. And the it is ultimately one of the key measures of performance of a business. Initially, that capital may be private, later it may be public, but it is fundamentally the question of defining the purpose of the firm, and that the purpose would nominally be to optimize this. However, here's the dilemma. The dilemma is that when you look at the creation of an industry, it does not have a sensitivity to that. When the greatest industries were born, the founders of the companies that succeeded in building these industries did not obsess about this. They threw a lot of capital. They actually wasted a lot of capital. And yet, wonderful things came out of that. And now, when you are in the late stage, you are so concerned about capital return that you do not want to allocate it to things which might burn it, which is exactly what you need to do at that moment of inception of an industry. So there's this kind of always with business, you always have contradictions. You have, let me define a good rule. And the rule is, example, optimize return on capital. But then you realize that it actually leads you into a very bad state at some other point in time, and vice versa. You could say, well, I'll burn capital. But then you also realize that that's a destructive problem at some point in the lifespan of a company. So it's all about when. It's not what is right or wrong, but rather when you should be doing the right thing. So that's how I see it. Anyway, is this something that makes sense to you?
Yeah. So absolutely. The fundamental problem is that there is a separation between the ownership and the management of the firm, right? If you have a family-owned business, there are no dilemmas, right? Everything's quite simple. Once the management and ownership get separated, you have what's known as principal-agent problems. You need some way of making sure that the management behaves in the interests of the owners, which is where the whole concept of maximizing shareholder value, which is implicitly maximizing return on capital. And sure, this is not, it's a little bit like the old saying, it's a terrible system apart from all the others. And there's certainly a lot of people who and in our work we come across it a lot, that say this short-term thinking, this risk aversion of these large companies with massive cash piles is sort of terrible for the global economy. You know, there's this concept of secular stagnation that's pretty popular. And these things are all true. But the reason you have the shareholder maximization kind of paradigm is to prevent bad management from simply frittering away the company.
Absolutely. So it isn't a rule that needs to be broken rather than adhered to. It's a rule that needs to be adhered to at the right time and in the right circumstances. And this is why you always have to qualify the rules of finance and business, that they're not universal. They're not axiomatic. The basic question, money now is better than money later. Well, yes, but you should spend money now, because otherwise you don't have growth, or you don't have a future. So there's always this fundamental contradiction, I would say, in any kind of rule-based system that is applied to finance and business. So within that context, I think this is important for us. It's a very kind of theoretical context, but within that context is where this industry sits, because it's at that crossroads where it's asking itself. We have been taught for the last 40, 50 years, we've all grown up as managers. We've all been trained in an MBA program or a training program of some kind to optimize this. This is what it means to do my job well. This is what I think generations of managers have absorbed, and yet this is the magic of disruption. When the new guy comes in, he breaks all these rules. And you not just break them, but you ignore them. You actually don't even know them. It just doesn't matter to you. You know, if Apple would come into this industry, they would not be sensitive to capital. They would open the wallet and just spend like drunken sailors on all kinds of neat things like factories and batteries and whatnot. And so they come in and everybody's goes pale looking at them. What are you doing? That's insanity. And this is why a lot of the incumbents and former CEOs, for example, of General Motors would say, you're absolutely insane to get into this business. We have overcapacity. Why would you build a new plant? We know what we're doing. You don't, et cetera, et cetera. But they come in because the rules that they come with are network effects. The rules they come with are ecosystems. They think about software cycle times. They think about microprocessor cycle times. And they say, well, maybe we could just swap these things in and out. And they have a modular mindset, fundamentally, I think. And then they run headlong into this. And I think what Tesla did is they run headlong into this. They say, I got it. I have a key to this whole puzzle. I'm going to make electric cars different. Powertrain will change the whole equation. But then they run back into the old capital questions because the equipment is so big, that's so costly, it takes so long to depreciate, and the only expertise that exists is how to operate that equipment, and you can't put new equipment that you can dream of on a clean sheet of paper, etc. So I think that's really the question is that, which is makes it really hard to pick the winners here. You cannot say ultimately that, yes, the incumbents will always win or the entrants will always win because, to be honest, both have something particularly valuable, but particularly also they have a vulnerability. I don't know if this actually will go the way of a big bang, that will go the way of completely what we think of as disruption, which in fact, by the way, brings me to this point, is that if we look at the history of the industry, disruption meant something else. In computing, we think disruption means the entrant wins all, and the incumbent loses all. They simply disappear. Nobody remembers Packard Bell as a computer maker, for example, or NEC as a computer maker.
Showing your age, Horace, come on.
But, well, you know, I've just looked at the data recently, so
yes.
I just freshened my mind. But we do remember, there are many dead brands in the car industry, but the brands that did survive are still 100 years old. Ford is there, General Motors is there. The newcomers, what they do, in fact, is they carve for themselves a piece of market share. Sometimes they grow it where it didn't exist before, as Volkswagen did. So don't forget, Volkswagen is a fairly recent newcomer. It only started after World War II, and with only one car up until the 70s or 60s, maybe. They had one iconic car. Same with Japan. Japan came on board on the global stage only in the late 1960s, early 70s, and didn't really gain any significant market share until the 80s. And then Korea came, and now China. And they're all coming essentially by having a local market, so they protect their home market. They allow these newcomers to gain a foothold in that local market, and they begin exporting. And this is the formula that's been used over and over again. It's how Volkswagen made its impact. It's how Japan, Korea, and China are doing it now. The point is that if the definition of disruption, I would not say that Toyota, because they didn't put GM out of business, what they did, but you can't.
Well, yeah, they
quite certainly fatal, put a lot of pain.
Yes,
they put a lot of pain on the incumbents, but the incumbents did not disappear. What happens is they expand the market and keep for themselves that new growth. And what's the question again is, how do we see then a technologically led introduction of a new thing like electric powertrain, like autonomy? Are these things going to enable new brands, or is it going to be sustaining to the old brands? This is the fundamental question.
Yeah, well, one thing a few points to address. One is, I don't think all the existing brands will disappear maybe this might be naive, but Volkswagen employs 600,000 odd people, right? When you employ this many people, you become the government's problem. And so, you know, they'll license whatever production system they need to, or come up with their own, they'll muddle through, I think. In terms of one, I agree sort of completely with your view on this, and also, you know, you've expressed in previous podcasts that I've listened to. My only question is sort of, is there a different, better way, really, of making this stuff? And the reason I say this is because, so, you know, you and I have talked a lot about iStream. BMW came up with their new carbon plant production system. So your question is sort of predicated on the assumption that there is a disruptive way to build cars.
Well, I don't know if there is or isn't, but the point is simply that I think the assumption, so let me say, I used to believe that there was a Big Bang theory, meaning that we just have to one cataclysmic introduction of a product or an idea into the market will cause it to crack and crumble. But I've since then moderated that thought. And I also my assumption was when you look at the candidates, I would look at an electric motor and battery pack, which is what Tesla introduced, as not that. I would just simply say, I don't think that's enough, because I've learned enough that to say that that's not sufficient to be that one Big Bang cause. Another one that people are proposing is well, when we get to autonomy, that's the Big Bang. Again, I stop to think and I ask, yes, I can see things changing, but will they really be causing a radical change? And then came notions around hydrogen, which actually I think is very sustaining because the complexity goes up and the integration is more important than ever. So yes, we have to look down this road and look at these candidates and then say, hang on, these are all technologies. They're not systems. They're not profit models yet. Maybe they will be. And we have to then ask ourselves, again, in order for something this big, this important, this many jobs involved, therefore this political, for that to change in such a dramatic way, maybe there's no single catalyst. Maybe it's going to have to happen through a series of events, a combination of things. By the way, we can go back to history and find what caused it in the first place and realize that that too was highly complex, involving forces that we haven't even been able to measure properly, like network infrastructures and the availability of fuels, the availability of distribution, the availability of roads, the availability of railroads to initially allow some of these roads to be built, etc. So I don't know. It's kind of like in many ways. Well, the reason this podcast is still going.
Still,
we haven't solved this.
Still,
We'll sign off the air once we got it.
Exactly. Well, we'll be around for forever. But, I think, yeah, in terms of the Big Bang, the only thing that makes sense to me that would overpower the resistance to close plants, to fire people, to fight with unions, to lay off workers, and so on and so on, is demand destruction, right? Mm-hmm. Something that just literally causes people to not buy cars.
Makes it irrelevant. Yeah.
And then if people are not buying cars, then the fact, you know, you can't keep factories open if they're producing things that are just sitting in port. And the only thing that sort of looks like it is going a little bit in that direction, at least, is and I'm ducking here as everyone starts throwing things at me, is Uber. Maybe something like that, where just the concept of owning your own car becomes irrelevant.
Yeah, it's not, and let's be clear, what that says is just not that people will stop wanting to move around. That was one of the theories we had a few years ago, because we saw driving miles being lower and lower because supposedly people didn't want to drive anymore, didn't want to go to the mall anymore, didn't want to socialize.
Sure, the young people are
Facebook.
Driving less and getting their fewer of them are getting driver's licenses, right?
Yes, I didn't believe those dreams either, because there might be a reduction in some markets, but there'll be an expansion in other markets because there's still vast non-consumption markets out there. I can imagine, you know, Africa coming on stream. That's a billion people. We've seen what happened with a billion in China. There's a billion in India that will become more mobile. They are to some extent, but usually with two-wheeled vehicles, not four. And so there's these billions of people that are unaddressed by what we think of traditional transportation. And no matter how much Facebook we have, we're still going to want, some of those people will want to be in a car. And as middle class and poverty is, middle class is increasing, poverty decreasing, again, more and more people will transition to a mobile lifestyle. And so cars are going to be a part of society, whether we slow down our miles or not. So that is important. But the next question, I think, is the one you bring up, is that if that is a shared service or not, if it is on demand, a utility type thing that you just push a button and it's always available. That again sounds great in theory. There are a lot of issues with it, though. I think in terms of because of the way we live. So here's the reason I struggle with this. It's a great idea if you live in San Francisco or in London, but it's not such a great idea if you live in the suburbs. Even if you make an instantaneous phone call, the density of housing means that the car will not show up for a while, and you can't rely on it the way you do today. A lot of people just could take public transport, but it's not that it's not available, it's just that it's inconvenient and slow, and it just doesn't have that productivity in terms of use of your time that a car does. And so that's why it's problematic, because of the way we live. If we all lived in cities like Hong Kong, which has a huge density of skyscrapers, which are residential, it makes a lot of sense. In fact, it doesn't make sense to have a car at all. You just take a subway, which is more efficient than driving even by taxi. And so it's about the way we live. And that living environment is the product of 100 years of automotive technology growth, right? It's the way we built a car that allowed us to live the way we do. And I think that's not going to change unless we rebuild our cities or build new ones in the form of Hong Kong or but look at new cities that have been born. Look at Dubai. I don't think it's a particularly pedestrian-friendly city, right? It's been built with the car in mind. So I don't know what will happen in Africa. I don't know what will happen in parts of Asia which are underdeveloped today. So it's tough.
I think I would agree. And 2 points. The first is, I think that's why, you're probably right, there won't be a big bang. But the second point is, a lot of these companies are working at such tight and volatile margins that, if only San Francisco and, you know, LA and the big metropolitan centers around the world sort of shift to some extent to some kind of shared ownership, and that knocks 10% off sales permanently, I don't think a lot of these companies will be able to survive that. They're operating so close to the bone. So there might be some
They'll be victims. Yes. But there have always been victims in terms of brands that have gotten in trouble, or even during the periods of what we thought of as equilibrium, which means that it's neither disruptive nor diffusive growth that we're seeing. So the case in point are probably the UK car makers. They mostly were divested during the 1980s and 90s. The UK is still making cars, but mostly under foreign ownership, as I understand it. And so that may happen in Italy as well. And in fact, Italy also has gone through this consolidation where all the brands are essentially Fiat today. They're, you know, Alfa and Maserati and Lancia and all those guys are gone as independent entities. And the U.S. consolidated even earlier into the big three. And so we might see more consolidation and more brands. We just saw Saab and disappear. We saw, you know, we might see again Volvo and some of the marginal players either disappear or become essentially boutique brands and nameplates that other people use to polish their other brands. And so yes, I agree with that. I mean, there is fragility in the system, but there's overcapacity. There's far too many companies, far too many brands. China is another one I want to talk about, because China, a few people know this, but China is the largest producer of cars today. We used to fret about Japan's Japan's encroaching on the big European and American brands, but now Japan is completely eclipsed by China, to some extent Korea as well. Korea is huge now, and China is even bigger. But China doesn't yet export, which is why we don't fear them. China is selling more cars than anyone else, but they're selling them in China, and so as a result, we don't even know the brands. And there's brands in China. I think the 10th biggest, or I don't know what exact number, but it's in the top 10. It's bigger than BMW, and so there are many, many brands in China that are impressive. And that's another thing that's disruptive, is that they seem to be coming from nowhere with a low-end proposition, ignored by all, and then suddenly they pop onto the global stage with cars that are just as good or good enough to meet local standard. And it's happened before more than once. So that's another factor that's coming into play, right? China. How do you see China?
So China is being... I remember 10 years ago, everyone was waiting with shaking knees for the Chinese auto invasion. Paradoxically, all of these burdensome safety emissions regulations that we know Volkswagen has been so studiously trying to meet are in large part the reason why the Chinese haven't come, because they're all quite difficult, as we've seen. Mm-hmm. And so, this is another... that's another example of the frictions in the auto industry, right? You can't just pitch up with four wheels and a steering wheel and start selling things. So I don't know about China. You know, in terms of financial issues, everyone sort of doesn't know whether to be optimistic or just cry out of desperation regarding what's going on there in their banking and real estate and all this and all these industries. So I'm not sure they're on a path to world domination that's particularly linear. Weirdly, if you do want to see some Chinese brands, you can go to Russia. They do have some penetration there. A lot of the taxis are Chinese brands. I suspect because the full Euro standards don't apply. I think they're still back on Euro 3 or something in Russia. But, you know, whenever I hear people talk about this, and we've been talking about this now, we sort of end up in these dead ends, right, where we should do this, but we can't because of X, Y, and Z. I think, what do you think of the odds of Apple in 2020 going, we don't have a solution. We're going to shut this thing down. Like, you know, everyone was expecting the television in 2010 or so, and it never came. This could be the same.
Exactly. Good point about television, actually. So this is another one that's even easier to envision, because there are far fewer constraints in television. But yet it hasn't cracked under the pressure of technologies, digital technologies. And the reason, again, is that even one of the constraints, which is in this case distribution via the cable system, is... holding up the evolution of everything, the experience and the business model. However, having said that, and it's easy to be cynical, I still anticipate that that'll happen. I see a theory we have does suggest that it'll happen. What we don't know is when and how. What we see, though, is the building of pressure, and we see weak signals like defections away from the existing business model. Newcomers, young people are not observing the old norms. And as a result, you end up with pressure building and building and building. And eventually, it's sort of like whimpers away and minds change rather quickly about whether it's going to change dramatically or not. So I think it's a wonderful study there as well, because I've been impatient. I've been thinking about how TV will change for years and years, and seemingly nothing happens. And I'm also reminded how mobility, when mobile phones came, people were saying, everybody's going to have a mobile phone. And it just looked like it was taking forever. It looked like we also said that people would stop having a landline. And that was very radical. For most of the 90s, 2000s, it was very radical to suggest that people will abandon the landline. And now, and more, we're seeing that that's actually a fait accompli, it's a done thing. So again, we can be very realistic and suggest that, look, this is complicated. This is not overnight. There is no big bang. There is, however, possibly an S curve, and it may be a slow one, but ultimately it goes from zero to one. It does cause a change to happen. It's impossible for things to stay the way they are indefinitely. These pressures build up slowly, but they do build up. And so that's where this is the crux of the questions. Is this, you know, we're struggling with timing more than we're struggling with outcome. At least, what do you think?
Yeah, one comparison I was going to make. Do you get the sense that if we compare the TV company attitude towards cutting the cord, for want of a better term, that seems to have been a lot more laid back and sort of dismissive. Whereas, you know, if you look at the automakers, they're all running around like headless chickens going mobility this and, smartphones on wheels and electric drive. Is there any room in the theory for the incumbents actually getting their act together?
There is, if it's sustaining to them. And this is, I think, where it comes down to it. There's the old Gandhi saying, you know, at first they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win, or something like that. There is this process of going through denial and eventually acceptance. And I sort of always think about it in my mind as an S curve, and the S curve, the way I describe it, is going from impossible to inevitable. And that's a change of mind. And I think that the car guys are in that stage where, again, because they have seen this happen, they can anticipate with some clarity how these machines would work if they were smart. They can anticipate how they would work if they were electric. It is foreseeable in many technical ways that you can measure things. What is unforeseeable is the strangeness of human behavior and how that affects this whole process. It's like, you know, we kind of made a joke about it when we talked about the Winnebago, the RV, the
roving Winnebagos, yes,
yeah, the autonomous Winnebago, which essentially is what should be the natural evolution of a driverless car, becomes a driverless house. That's the sort of thing that happens on the way there. On the way up the S-curve, we realize that it isn't that vision we had of a horseless carriage. That is what the original car was. It was a horseless carriage. But what we ended up with is, yes, that, but it actually is something so much more enabling to so many different things, and so it has such an impact on society in terms of how we live. We didn't expect that we invent a horseless carriage and we end up with suburbs, or that we end up with superhighways that allow discount stores to be placed at interchanges called malls. We don't imagine any of that. And so, in fact, possibly what the outcome is that, okay, electric cars plus autonomy leads to a new city architecture, new workspaces, new ways of living, new ways of thinking. Who knows? We really can't anticipate that. And it's by definition unforeseeable. The question, so theory suggests that it will change. What we also suggest, though, is that change is invisible to us and can never be revealed until we get there, that there's a process due to complexity and due to the human, involving the human in the blend, the jobs analysis, which is really psychology, involving that, plus millions of entrepreneurs pushing constantly in parallel on the problem, that leads to this strangeness of outcome. And what I think most people who do extrapolate dots on the page of ruled paper is that they extrapolate technical things, and those are easy to extrapolate. In one of my conferences, I showed a whole bunch of visuals which were posters or advertising from the 1940s and 50s showing the brighter future. This was in a sense modernism, and it had an effect on architecture. It had an effect on on transportation, where people thought that the future was an extrapolation of the last 40 years, which were the invention of the car, the invention of the airplane, the invention of radio, and many other things that they saw in their lifespan, and they just extrapolated those. So we would end up with, like, you know, supersonic planes and cars that were driving themselves within a few years. What happened was far stranger. We ended up with, where, like I said, suburbs and television, partly because of that. So, you know, it's curious. It's a very curious thing to try to plan, and I think I don't know where to take it, but I think we just need to keep thinking about it, keep iterating, and I think that the financial aspects of it are another piece of the puzzle. I think that financially.
I agree, and that was really the gist of my original question, was when you see Apple's introduction of their recent devices and then the emphasis on the monthly payments, their use of older or smaller devices to enter new markets, let's say a resale market, which is analogous to Svi's point about CPO cars. You know, are there new models that might change the experience? And that's sort of what I was getting at between Uber and the legacy system of
leases. I think what we're seeing is that we look at it in a small space and we see logic. We see things that might work. We can't do that. We can't do that globally. We only see locally. And everything is valid. Yes, electric cars work, but maybe not for everyone. Autonomous cars work.
Well, Svi, closing suggestions or comments from you?
Yeah, I just couldn't leave you without mentioning that when I heard the podcast with Horace describing the sort of roving bumper to bumper Winnebagos, I had nightmares about this dystopian future. Speaking of Kant, difficult to predict the future. One thing it just triggered in my mind is. One of the reasons we keep hitting dead ends is because we have, have the same roads, have the same tires, more or less, four of them, and a steering wheel. But I follow the sort of aviation industry in a similar fashion to what I do the auto industry. And recently I heard a podcast, which sort of a throwaway line in a podcast, which shocked me, which was saying that people are sort of expecting drones, human-sized drones, to come soon, with improvements in batteries and electric motors. You know, maybe that's something out of left field.
Right.
Maybe the whole car thing is maybe in the future we really won't need roads.
Segway version 2.0.
Yeah, no, it's we should continue this because actually yes. Tooled vehicles may be more interesting as the evolution of that into a micro car of some kind.
Right.
Again, it's absolutely it never ends. This does it.
Yes.
It's great to have you tell us all this. Tell us how we're wrong.
On track or off track, exactly. Svi, thanks so much. Great
is
show.
There just a quick question.
Else?
Is there something we should mention? His Twitter.
Oh yes.
My Twitter is @srozov, all one word. Follow me for ramblings about car industry and London cycle infrastructure. I have a blog about finance issues if you are that way inclined. It's Market Integrity Insights. You can Google it. It'll come up. And it's been great talking to you guys. I'm looking forward to this podcast about the, you know, the Soviet cars. That'll be fun.
Yeah, we'll post links to the your Twitter and your blog in the show notes as well, Svi. Yeah.
Maybe that'll be how not to do it.
Yeah, right. All right.
Excellent.
Thanks so much.
All right. Cheers, guys.
Yeah.